It's not just summer anymore. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The U.S., Greece, Sweden, Japan, just some of the places around the globe struggling to cope with deadly wildfires and record heat. So what's that say about global climate?
This is an evolutionary change that we're seeing happen in front of our eyes. It's very dramatic to see it happening with wildfires and heat waves, but this is the process by which the planet's changing.
We'll also get the latest on how Greek authorities handled the wildfires there, and later, remembering one of the Soviet Union's top chess players, Ludmila Rudenko.
She was never really a professional chess player, as I understand, but she was an economic planner in the Soviet days.
Those stories and much more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Thanks for being with us on this Friday. Hope you're staying cool where you are. Here in Boston, it's been a hot and sticky few days. But that's nothing compared to what a lot of other places around the globe are going through right now.
Temperatures are reaching record highs across much of Europe and the world. The consequences of the hot weather are starting to show their effects.
Fast-moving flames are torching one house after another in Northern California.
Tourists are evacuating Yosemite National Park this morning because of dangerous conditions from a nearby wildfire.
Now, Sweden has called for international help to fight more than 40 wildfires that have broken out across the country. Weeks of high temperatures and minimal rain.
Japan is experiencing a record-breaking heat wave, which officials say contributed to the death of 65 people last week.
And in the UK, formerly green fields have turned to beige as there has been no rain in some places for 54 consecutive days.
Fast and unforgiving, flames devoured seaside resort towns along Greece's eastern coast, bustling with summer tourists.
We'll get to the global picture in a moment with all this heat, but let's start with those fires in Greece. They've had tragic consequences. More than 80 people died this week, and dozens more are still missing after a wildfire spread to the Greek seaside resort town of Mati. It's just a few miles from the capital, Athens. High winds drove the fire toward the sea. People ran toward the relative safety of the water, but many were trapped by cliffs or buildings. After 3 days of official mourning, the disaster has now gotten political. Yannis Papadopoulos is a journalist with the newspaper Kathimerini. So what exactly is making people angry right now?
Many things are making people angry. First of all, the way that the Greek officials acted after the deadly fire. Just today, the Greek Prime Minister, Mr. Alexis Tsipras, he assumed political responsibility for the deadly fires. However, yesterday, at a press conference, the Greek Minister of Civil Protection and the head of the Greek Fire Service, they basically said that the Greek firemen and the Greek police did whatever humane possible. And they basically didn't assume any responsibility for the outcome of the fires. They claimed that because of the heavy winds, because of the very tough weather, it was almost impossible to save more people.
But despite the contrition and explanations, Greeks are still really angry.
Yes, because I believe that the Greek public opinion wants to hear an apology. They might expect a resignation.
Wildfires are not unusual in Greece. In the town of Mati, we understand, had a pretty thorough emergency evacuation plan. How well did the emergency services respond, in your opinion?
Well, the case about Mati is that on the same day, last Monday, we had a major wildfire in Kineta, which is an area at the other part of Attica.
That's the same region, correct?
Yes, the same region, but many kilometers farther west than Mati. So what happened there was that at least three suburban areas were evacuated and there were no victims of the fire. However, the fire force was sent there in its full force. So there were not enough vehicles or airplanes or people to send to Mati, to that area, when the fire occurred there.
Then there are other problems being reported that are more to do with urban planning, like houses being built without permits, either too close to the forest or without enough exits. What have you heard about that?
It is not clear if those places have permits. However, what is actually very easy noticeable is that Posidonos Avenue, the main road where people were trapped in Mati, is a very, very narrow street. And it is very difficult for vehicles going in opposite directions. And you can imagine what can happen during a state of panic, how people can easily get trapped there. And another crucial factor is the way that the buildings are built in that area, and people don't have easy access to the sea where they tried to flee from the fire. So there are many, many things to check there and many, many things to correct.
Yannis Papadopoulos with the Greek newspaper Kathimerini in Athens. Thank you very much for the update.
You're welcome.
As we just heard, one part of the world where wildfires have been raging this week is Sweden, a place that's not known for its hot and dry conditions. Martin Hedberg joins us from Sweden. He's a meteorologist and a writer. So what is the latest on this week's fires in Sweden, Martin, and the weather conditions that have been contributing to them?
Well, today there's about 20,000 hectares of forest which is actively burning right now in Sweden. And yeah, there's still a lot of fires in the woods. But actually, tomorrow there will be some precipitation and some lightning as well that will cause some relief on the fires. It's not going to put the fires out because we need weeks of rain to do that, but it's going to stop the fires from this violent spreading that we've seen for the last couple of days.
Yeah, well, that will hopefully be a little relief. Do you connect these fires in Sweden to any climate phenomena?
Yeah, this was expected.
What is the connection?
Well, the thing is that we've had this blocking high and there's been some very dry conditions for about 2 months. So there's a lot of potential for fires. And once that happens and the conditions are so dry, you get this big fires. And the drought in itself and the very warm weather that we've had for about 2 months, that is directly connected to the climate.
So let me bring Erik Holthaus into the conversation. He's also a meteorologist and is a staff writer at GRIST. Erik, I know you've been monitoring some of the other weather extremes around the world this summer. Japan, Algeria, Oman, Montreal, I mean, all records everywhere. What's going on and how do you connect these heat patterns to wildfires?
Oh, man, it's hard to know where to start. We expect extreme weather like this every summer. We're right now at the end of the hottest month of one of the hottest years in human history. I mean, this is what the weather is like now. And it's not really appropriate to refer to this as a new normal because it's not going to stabilize. We're going to continue to have more extreme heat waves more frequently. And that's been projected for decades now.
I mean, we're seeing people die. In Japan, there were 65 people who died in a single week, 22,000 people hospitalized after its highest temperature in history, 106 degrees. That was this summer. What are some of the impacts of an increase in heat waves around the world? I mean, aside from fatalities.
Yeah, sure. I think that heat waves are among the most important and deadliest public health impact of climate change. So if you have a place like the UK that doesn't have air conditioning, less than 1% of UK households have air conditioning, there's no place to recover. And our bodies need time to recover from temperatures that we're not used to. When that doesn't happen is when people start having health impacts.
Yeah, and those homes that do have air conditioning, of course, those ACs go on and that increases energy use, which goes into kind of a feedback loop, right?
Yeah, yeah. And this is really, you know, we can think of air conditioning as an adaptation tool to climate change, especially in a place like India. There is a huge number of households that don't have electricity at all. So we're needing to think about how can we provide life-saving climate change adaptation technology that the rest of the world has to a place in and have carbon-free energy at the same time. So we're not contributing to climate change at the same time as we're trying to keep people safe.
Martin Hedberg, in Sweden, there have always been weather extremes, and we can't exactly blame any one weather event or even one hot year on human-induced climate change. But this is what we've been warned about, right? I mean, how big a shock is this to people in Sweden?
Yeah, people are a bit surprised, of course. As you say, we've had heat waves before, but the number of heat waves and the strength of them are so, it's so huge. So you actually can say this is due to climate change. We have caused these extreme events to happen. There's no way this would have happened unless we had added so much carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases to the atmosphere.
Yeah, well, I mean, I feel like a broken record asking this question, but what can we do? So when I say we, I mean we as individuals, but also we, mm-hmm. nations, governments. What can individuals do?
Yeah, we can cooperate. And we need to realize that this is for real. It's not a hoax. It's not something that scientists just made up to get more funding or anything like that. And what we're doing right now is that we're messing around in the system. It's obvious that climate is changing and we know the cause of it. And the speed of it is not only that it's happening right now, the speed of it, it's between 50 and 100 times faster than natural climate change. We need to cooperate and I don't think it's
Cooperate how? I mean, let's start with individuals. I mean, what does that actually mean to cooperate together?
Well, as an individual, you can figure out how do you depend on, for instance, on fossil fuel? Are you dependent on it or not? And how can you decrease the dependence? Wherever you have an impact going forward in order to try to change to a low carbon energy and more renewable energy and realize that we have to sort of downsize the amount of energy that we use in order to lower the emissions and in order to let other people who are not so wealthy as we are to actually increase their welfare.
Yeah, I mean, some people have said, it's a whole recalibration of the global economy. Eric Holthaus, what can governments, both national and local, do to deal with this kind of heat? I mean, was the Paris Agreement not strong enough? And now with the U.S. having pulled out of it, what's left to do?
The most important thing that we can do is talk about climate change and talk about how it affects our life. And most importantly, imagine the world that we want to have and then work backwards to figure out what changes we need to make in our everyday lives and our policies in the way our government works now.
I mean, I was just reading this killer stat today, the 109-degree Fahrenheit reading in Kiryat, Oman on June 28th, kind of blew meteorologists away because that was not the day's high temperature. That was the low temperature, the hottest low temperature ever recorded on Earth. So in the middle of this kind of heat, talking about climate change, doesn't that feel like it's not enough?
It's a no-brainer for a lot of people, but until we talk about it directly and make that link, it's not going to be on the front of people's minds as these things are happening, and they're not going to imagine what they can do or what policies need to change. And we're not going to be building that political will towards radical change. I really think that making the choice to talk about climate change whenever you have the opportunity to, with anyone who will listen, is a radical change that you can do in your own life that's going to make a huge amount of difference.
So, Eric, I was going to ask you how this hot summer has hit you emotionally, but maybe you can leave us on a positive note. Leave us with a story that, kind of suggests the kind of world we want to be in.
Yeah, so I have two little kids, too. So I'm watching all this happen, and you can see the world through their eyes a lot easier. Youth around the world are recognizing this as their issue. You know, this is their world that they're fighting for, and they're fighting for the right to survive. And you see them voicing that, and that just gives me a lot of hope personally.
Eric Holthaus is a meteorologist and a staff writer at Grist. Martin Hedberg, a Swedish meteorological consultant and speaker on weather and climate. Thank you both very much for being with us today. Stay cool.
Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Okay, so we were just hearing from a couple of climate experts with their take on the record temperatures and dangerous wildfires breaking out all over the Northern Hemisphere right now. Of course, you don't need to be a climate expert to figure out that it's super hot outside. And it's not just hot, it's dry, too. In many places, prolonged drought is leaving fields brown and making life difficult for farmers, even at a time of year when they might be starting to think about harvesting their grain crops. So here now are some thoughts from two farmers. One is Megs Reynolds. She's in Saskatchewan up in Canada. But first, here's Matthew Grindle, a farmer in the Midlands region over in the United Kingdom.
We had the worst winter we've had for a long time, then followed by end of April. We went from sort of winter to sort of spring to summer in a matter of number of days. And May was very hot and dry, although we did have torrential rain at the end of May. And then 25th of May, I think, was our last rain. Not weather that we're used to in the UK, you know.
When Matthew talked about going from an extremely harsh winter into summer, that is exactly what we had pretty much all winter. So we went through a ton of feed for animals. The way they stay hot is, or keep their body temperature up, is by eating. So you need to have extra food rations. Ranchers were really relying on being able to have a good hay gear to replace those rations. And, you know, we just finished cutting and baling our own stuff. We've got about 20 head of cattle, and we got a third of the bales that we normally get. And the pastures are all just drying up. So we're in a similar position. We might be needing to start feed hay that we've put aside for winter. So it's just to start feeding now. That's hard.
The potatoes we grow look okay at the minute, but they're not doing anything now. So if we don't get any rain for another 2 weeks, I think there'll probably be a write-off. Everywhere we look with the wheat and the barley and stuff, they're all shriveled up. The quality won't be there and the yields won't be there. So it's already had an effect on a lot of stuff.
We seeded a little bit later than normal because we were dealing with that winter that went longer than normal. I was going one day and I actually had to shut the AC off in the tractor because it was overheating. So I kind of roasted myself in the tractor trying to keep seeding when the temperature was something that we don't normally see during seeding for us.
That was Megs Reynolds in Saskatchewan up in Canada and Matthew Grindle in England, two farmers in different parts of the Northern Hemisphere, both experiencing serious challenges because of the record heat this summer. The Google Doodle, you know, the little drawings on the Google homepage, it's not just a wormhole to get lost in. It's also a great source for interesting stories. Like today, Google honors what would have been the 114th birthday of Ludmila Rudenko. Not a household name, and that's why we want to go deeper on today's doodle. Rudenko died in 1986 at the age of 81, but during her lifetime, she was one of the most influential chess champions of the Soviet era. In 1928, she placed fifth in the Moscow Women's Championship, and in the early 1950s, she became the second woman's world chess champion. All very interesting, except her proudest achievement was saving hundreds of children during the bloody siege of Leningrad in World War II. Susan Polgar is a world chess champion herself and a chess grandmaster. I kind of got to the thumbnail sketch of Ludmila Rudenko. Susan, where was she born and how did she become a champion chess player?
Well, Ms. Rudenko was born in today's territory of Ukraine and then later moved to Russian territories of Moscow and I guess Leningrad as well. She was very influential in her era. And it's pretty remarkable that she was never really a professional chess player, as I understand, but she was an economic planner in the Soviet days. And she became world champion in her mid-40s, which is highly unusual by today's standards. For example, I became the number one ranked player in the world when I was only 15. But times are different. There were no computers, no technology, no information like there is today. So it's much quicker, the development of chess players today. That's how we see young chess players, even at the tender age of 12, and becoming grandmasters.
How much was sexism kind of holding Ludmila Rudenko back at the time?
Oh, I'm sure a lot. I mean, even in my early days in the 70s and 80s, I had to face it on a day-to-day basis and to some degree even today. But in those days, forget sexism, just World War II and everything that she had to endure. And there was so much lack of opportunity for women or support or so much discrimination. It's remarkable that she had the strength and the motivation and the desire to excel in such a male-dominated sport.
Do you know how she was perceived by her male peers at the time?
I very well know because I have traveled to the Soviet Union multiple times and I talked to people who knew her and even other champions who came after her. And it was just such a dismissal, so to say, in those days, in her time, about women in chess, that, oh, women can't play chess. And in fact, part of the reason why women didn't get very far in chess, because that constant discouragement and dismissal and lack of opportunities. And, well, in fact, that's what I try to change throughout my life and my career and now through my foundation.
So we'll get to that in a second. But what about Lyudmila Rudenko inspired you?
Well, it inspired me that she stood up in a male-dominated field when it was not popular. There was only one other woman before her, Vera Menchik, who we all know about, the first women's world champion, who did that. And then the World War II broke out and there were no real championships. There were no competitions for women at all. And so she was the first one. It's always hard to be a pioneer in whatever you do and excel at. And I think we all need to remember that power and that inspiration.
So tell me more about this scholarship money that you've awarded this week, the 15th year in a row you've done this, to girls who play chess.
Yes, we're very fortunate that found partners for the past 7 years already here at Webster University. And my foundation adds to it some further cash prizes to the winners, the young ladies who compete for these valuable prizes. And we hear wonderful success stories when young people, even if they quit chess playing professionally or seriously and get other careers, they are becoming extremely successful and sought out employees by various fields.
And for these 21st century girls, do they know the legacy and lore of Lyudmila Rudenko?
Well, I believe that all young women chess players are familiar with the limited amount of women's world champions in the history of the game. And Lyudmila being just the second, obviously, everybody's familiar with the name.
World chess champion Susan Polgar in St. Louis, Missouri, telling us about the subject of today's Google Doodle, the late Russian chess champion Lyudmila Rudenko, who would have been 114 today. Susan, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. Just ahead on the world, Muslim students stand up to bullying, but some parents fight to keep Islam out of schools.
See, every time people say Islamophobia, I think that's just another reason to cover up the real facts that are going on.
The legal battle playing out in San Diego, coming up here on the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. 2 years ago this month, July 2016. Remember what was going on then?
Let me ask you, have you even read the United States Constitution? I will gladly lend you my copy.
The final night of the Democratic National Convention, Khizr Khan, father of a Muslim American soldier who died during the Iraq War, he stood at the podium waving a pocket version of the U.S. Constitution, addressing then-presidential candidate Donald Trump. In response, Trump tweeted that Khan was attacking him when the focus should have been on radical Islam. We know now that while those events were playing out nationally, activists were documenting a dramatic rise in hate crimes across the country, directed especially at Muslims. Schools were one of the places where it was happening, a lot. So the Council on American-Islamic Relations, an organization that's become a prominent voice for Muslims in recent years, started a national push to address tensions in schools. But not everyone welcomed it. The World's Rupa Shenoy has a story of how things have progressed since then.
July 2016. A girl stepped up to the mic at a meeting of the San Diego Board of Education.
Good evening. My name is Sohaila Jibeli. I'm going to sixth grade. I love school and science.
Jibeli said the year before, three boys in school started calling her names. And when no one stopped them, they hit her, kicked her, and pushed her.
I didn't feel safe. I told my teacher I didn't feel safe. But she didn't react to that.
Jibeli was followed by other Muslim kids and parents with similar stories. And that night, the Board of Education voted unanimously to develop an anti-bullying program focused on Islamophobia.
Cast your vote. And the vote is unanimous.
San Diego district staff started putting the new program together with some help from CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Mike Sullivan is a lawyer for the district.
There were some books that CARE recommended. The district vetted those. Anyone who looks at those books sees they're not advocating at all for Islamic beliefs. They're simply trying to give an understanding of why bullying is not appropriate.
We very much appreciate the way that CARE has been involved in our community and civic engagements.
Superintendent Cindy Martin presented a plan for the initiative last year. It would create safe spaces for Muslim students, send staff and parents letters about Islamophobia, make sure school calendars list Muslim holidays, and include Islamic history and culture in social studies lessons. Kids who were caught bullying Muslim students wouldn't be disciplined with detention. Instead, schools would use a restorative justice method where the accused student and alleged victim talk to repair their relationship.
And with that, please vote.
The board voted again to unanimously approve the plan. And that's when Jose Velasquez went searching for an attorney who'd listen to his concerns about CARE.
I actually went down to the school board to see the meeting. Unfortunately, I couldn't find parking.
Velasquez is a Navy veteran whose kids go to San Diego schools.
CARE is creating division using religion, and that's not right. Their agenda is to promote Islam in the school districts, in the schools.
He was frustrated by the board's decision because he didn't understand why the district needed a special new program. Velasquez says he got bullied as a kid, and his children had been bullied, and they just went to the principal and complained, and that worked. So it should work for Muslim kids, too. I asked him what he thought about what Jabeli had said, the girl who told the board her teacher hadn't protected her.
You know, the thing is, CARE organized that whole thing. Is it true or not? I believe if something is true enough, then you as a parent have a responsibility to go to the office and talk to the principal.
Velasquez found a team of pro bono lawyers called the Freedom of Conscience Defense Fund, including attorney Daniel Piedra. They filed an injunction on the grounds that the district was singling out Muslim students as a privileged religious group.
If they're going to work with CARE, then any other organization should have the same equal access. But you know what? We doubt that that will happen. So we think the reasonable solution would be just to have CARE out of the schools completely.
In response to concerns, the San Diego Board of Education revised their earlier plans. They decided instead to create an intercultural committee and work more with the Anti-Defamation League, a group who says its values are rooted in Jewish beliefs. This is the attorney for the district, Mike Sullivan, again.
We don't think there was anything inappropriate that they did initially, but certainly as revised to make sure that it was clear to everyone that they were not favoring any religion, that this was an effort to prevent, you know, all bullying with regard to anyone with any religious beliefs in the district.
That move by the district, taking a step away from CARE, that frustrated another group of parents.
Hi, my name is Laura Beiser, and I'm a parent in the San Diego Unified School District. I want to thank the school board for approving of the policy to combat Islamophobia. Given the current misinformation and fear shown by a small group of parents, it is clear that this program is much needed in our communities.
But the group of parents worried about CARE's involvement with the district weren't satisfied. They said people working on the revised program were still talking with CARE. So the lawsuit continued, and it got plenty of play in the media. CARE's attorney, Gadir Abbas, says that's part of what the Freedom of Conscience Defense Fund was trying to accomplish.
Their theory of why the San Diego School District's interactions with CARE are problematic is premised on these conspiratorial notions that CARE is not an American organization run by U.S. citizens that are grounded in their communities and are somehow CARE is a nefarious group aimed at displacing American law.
Even though CARE's never been charged with criminal activity.
I think there's a very determined, well-organized group of organizations that have as their mission the marginalization of the Muslim community all across the United States. This lawsuit legitimizes false beliefs that anti-Muslim bullying is a fiction, when in fact it's an emerging phenomenon that affects most Muslim students anywhere in the country.
Abbas says that's why CARE's working with many students and school districts nationwide to address Islamophobic bullying.
The San Diego case, unfortunately, might be the first of many attempts to exclude CARE and Muslim communities from their own schools in an attempt to isolate the Muslim communities and allow anti-Muslim bullying to fester.
The litigation's been playing out slowly over the last year until it sped up this month. The judge in the case heard arguments last week and may rule at any time. Velasquez is hopeful.
I got kids in school. They should not be treated differently. CARE itself publicly called us Islamophobes, bigots, racists. You know, they don't even know me. I'm Hispanic, you know, serve my country. See, every time people say Islamophobia, I think that's just another reason to cover up the real facts that are going on.
Sullivan, the attorney for the district, says it's always maintained that no one's being treated differently. And the district works with all community groups, including religious ones.
What plaintiffs have requested is the notion that the district not have any relationship with CARE, that they think it's inappropriate to have any relationship with CARE because they disagree with CARE. That is what would be inappropriate.
In other words, Sullivan says if the school district refused to have any contact with CARE, that, in and of itself, would be religious discrimination. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Pakistan held national elections on Wednesday, and the outcome is still not clear. Recall that the country is a key U.S. ally in South Asia. Also remember that Pakistan has nuclear weapons. So far, the official results of this week's vote show the party of former star cricket player Imran Khan winning the most seats in parliament, but several other parties dispute that. They say the vote was rigged, and they accuse Khan of being a puppet of Pakistan's military. My BBC colleague Sikandar Kermani is in Islamabad. He says Imran Khan rode his cricket popularity into politics more than two decades ago, but his real rise to power started more recently.
It's only in the past kind of five, six, seven, 8 years that he's really come to the fore as a political force. But now, certainly in this campaign, he's been holding huge rallies and he's really energized a lot of younger voters. He's a very charismatic man. His message has been one of anti-corruption, of creating a fairer, more egalitarian society. Unlike a lot of other politicians in Pakistan, he doesn't come from a big political dynasty, and he's not. There's no allegations of corruption against him personally. And even just those two simple things make him quite unusual within a Pakistani political context. And so he is really adored by a lot of his supporters, and a lot of people have voted for him, it seems, because they just wanted change.
What is Imran Khan's relationship with the military, and is there any suggestion that they were crucial to his victory?
Well, certainly a lot of analysts believe that the Pakistani military wanted the PMLN party out of power because they say the former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif was trying to assert his own independent foreign policy, and that was something that the military, so it said, didn't want him to do. And so the belief is that Imran Khan was the preferred kind of option instead of Nawaz Sharif. Now, how much support did he get from them? It's hard to say. We've had allegations that candidates from the PMLN were told by members of the security services to defect and join Imran Khan's party. We certainly have seen a substantial number of defections, and that is one of the contributing factors to why Imran Khan has won. But it's also true that Imran Khan is a hugely popular politician in his own right. So it's really hard to measure what part of his victory we can attribute to this alleged support from the military and what part we can attribute to his own political skills.
You know, there used to be so much news coverage of Pakistan here in the States because of the belief that Pakistan was a key ally in the South Asia region. Today, how is the U.S.-Pakistani relationship seen from there?
Certainly, ever since President Trump came to power, there has been a more fractious relationship, it seems, with Pakistan. His new South Asia policy, which he announced in August last year, said that Pakistan needed to do more to combat alleged safe havens for the Taliban militants who are active in Afghanistan, but who he says were using these kind of bases across the border in Pakistan. Since the announcement of that strategy, though, the relationship has somewhat repaired. We saw, for example, a ceasefire a while back in Afghanistan between the Afghan government and the Afghan Taliban. It's not clear exactly how much role Pakistan had in creating that ceasefire, but certainly they didn't play the role of a spoiler, which is something that, from the discussions I've had, international diplomats seem to be quite happy about. So it's a tense relationship, but it's one that at the moment shows some signs of improving. But it's a relationship that's often focused through the lens of the Afghan war.
I mean, Trump's criticism of veiled support from the Pakistan military for Taliban extremists along the border, it's been repeated by many people. And the U.S. did pull financial support for Pakistan last year. What kind of relationship does Imran Khan hope to forge with the United States? Do we have any signs of that?
Well, Imran Khan in the past has been more populist, more nationalist. He, for example, when he was in opposition, he was a strident opponent of U.S. drone strikes in the tribal regions bordering Pakistan and Afghanistan. He had opposed the U.S. presence in Afghanistan. And now that position seems to have been somewhat toned down. He's said in interviews before the elections that he realizes that Pakistan needs to have a good and solid relationship with America, although he has said that he wants to somewhat rebalance it. Exactly what kind of tone he will strike, it remains to be seen. Some of his critics have actually compared him to Donald Trump because he's someone who's got a big personality, let's say, who can adopt a kind of populist rhetoric at times. I'm not sure if either of them would necessarily like that comparison, but it will be an interesting dynamic to see how they get on with each other.
Yeah, do you think they could sit down together and have a conversation, Imran Khan and Donald Trump?
Well, Imran Khan certainly said that he can sit down with anyone, and he believes it's important to do so. And I'm sure President Trump as well knows that Pakistan is key to peace in this region, certainly to securing the future, a peaceful future in Afghanistan. So I'm sure there will be discussions at some stage that will take place between the two of them.
The BBC Sikandar Kermani in Islamabad on the results of Pakistan's election, which seems to have put Imran Khan into the premiership. Thanks very much, Sikandar.
Thank you.
Sumo wrestling and Japan are inseparable. And here's something you may not know. Sumo and Japanese politics are also inseparable. And they've got this in common. Women are barely represented. In fact, Japan has the fewest women in elected office in the industrialized world. And when it comes to sumo, the sacred wrestling ring is a no-go zone for women. But one of Japan's few female mayors is pushing back. Abigail Leonard reports from Tokyo.
To understand how important sumo wrestling is in Japan, you have to go back to the beginning, the very beginning. According to legend, Japan was created when two gods battled in a sumo wrestling match. The emperor is said to be descended from the god who won that match. Sumo has always been a major cultural tradition here. And even today, hundreds of thousands of fans tune in to nationally televised matches that still incorporate historic Japanese rituals. The sport is so revered by the Japanese that the Sumo Association is given quasi-government status and pays fewer taxes than other private organizations. But despite its government support, women are prevented from entering the sumo wrestling ring, which is considered sacred.
I think this is discrimination. I don't think it's right.
That's Naomi Koshi. She's the mayor of a small lakeside city called Otsu. Later this month, thousands of fans will come to Otsu to watch a major sumo wrestling match on its annual summer tour. Normally, the mayor welcomes the crowd and the wrestlers and gives a speech from inside the ring. But Koshi is a woman, so she's prohibited from doing that.
I'm a mayor, and I'm a public figure, so I can't be treated differently from men.
Koshi and some other female mayors in Japan have sent a petition to the Sumo Wrestling Association, asking that it change its policy and do away with the ancient tradition of excluding women from the ring. Earlier this summer, the issue got major media attention when a male politician collapsed in the ring before a televised match, and a nurse rushed in to begin CPR, but was immediately ejected by officials. Panicked officials can be heard on the loudspeaker yelling, "Ladies, please leave the ring." That incident struck a chord among Japanese women who saw it as a symbol of their second-class status here. Naomi Koshi saw it as an opportunity to use her political office to further the constitutional rights of women in Japan.
Because the constitution provides men and women should be treated equally, there is a national attention about women can go in the ring.
There are 1,700 mayors in Japan, and only 20 of them are female. Koshi, at 42, is the youngest. She says she knew she wanted to go into politics at a very early age. Growing up in Otsu, her mother had to quit her job as a designer when her grandmother got sick so she could take care of her. And that's when Koshi realized she could make a difference through politics.
It was hard for family, and I start think about we have to change this system. So I start thinking about politics, especially local politics.
But she soon learned there were different roles for men and women. When she graduated from college, she saw Japanese employers only offer job interviews to the male graduates.
And at that time, I first realized men and women are not equal in Japan.
Koshi decided to go to law school, in part because the admission test was gender blind. She eventually landed a job working for the country's largest law firm. The firm sent her to Harvard, where she got an additional degree in international law and a lesson in campus politics.
It was great. And actually, that experience changed my life.
It was 2008, the year of the presidential election, and students on campus were vocal and engaged in the campaign. She was impressed.
In Japan, we don't see that young people are interested in politics. So I think I should do something to change Japan.
When she returned to Japan, Koshi decided to run for mayor on a woman-centered platform. But it was a tough message to deliver on the campaign trail. Men yelled sexist remarks, and one even kicked her as she was out greeting voters.
I was just surprised, and I couldn't do anything. But my supporters, they chased him, but he ran away.
During her 6 years in office, Koshi has managed to enact policies that make life better for women. Her administration built 20 new nurseries for about 2,000 children, eliminating the long wait lists. And all male city employees are now required to take paternity leave. With her family-friendly programs, Mayor Koshi has actually been able to affect the birth rate in Otsu, which is now on the rise, while the rest of Japan's continues to decline. But what about her fight to change the ancient tradition of sumo wrestling and make it more inclusive to women? For its part, the Sumo Association declined numerous requests for an interview, but said in a statement it's considering the mayor's petition, and the next step will be to conduct a public survey. That response does not satisfy Mayor Koshi.
They can take a survey, but they should explain why they treat women different from men.
The big sumo match is coming to Otsu on Monday. And unless she's invited into the ring to greet the crowd, this mayor says she will have other plans. For The World, Abigail Leonard in Tokyo.
So Japan lags behind in female empowerment. Well, here's one area where women, foreign women anyway, are welcome in Japan. This is the Japanese funk band Osaka Monorail, and this is British soul singer Shirley Davis, who teamed up with them a few years ago.
I'm standing on a mountain, looking out across.
Shirley Davis's backstory, born to Jamaican parents in London in 1974, fell in love and moved to Australia when she was 15. By 23, she was a divorced single mom who was encouraged by friends to sing because they heard her natural gift. And soon Davis was a fixture on Melbourne's soul and funk scene. Fast forward to 2014 when Shirley Davis was on vacation in Spain. She went to see a concert by a singer she'd already been friends with, the late Sharon Jones, and got pulled on stage for a duet. Two record execs were in the audience. They signed Ms. Davis and got a band together for her, the Silverbacks. They're now on to their second album, Wishes and Wants, including this number, Treat Me Better.
Treat me better.
We'll leave you today with the sounds of Shirley Davis and the Silverbacks. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. Our theme music, composed by Eric Goldberg. Have yourselves a great weekend. We're back with you here on Monday.
I didn't know what bothered you, but it was not my fault. You were focusing on all my bad faults.
But never looked at you. PRI, Public Radio International.